Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is natural historian, writer, editor, Jeremy Minot, emeritus fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge. He, along with Michael McCarthy and Peter Marin, have written a wonderful book called The Consolation of Nature, Spring in the Time of the Coronavirus. Jeremy, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you very much for having me again, Mark. It's good to be in another conversation with you.
This book affected me emotionally, mainly because we were all living through the same experience, and I don't think that happens an awful lot. It's an amazing book. How did the three of you get together to decide to write this journal of the natural world in spring of 2020 when COVID was happening?
Yeah, well, in the early days of March of that year, when the first cases were beginning to appear in Europe, particularly in Italy, and then a few in the UK, an old friend of mine called Mike McCarthy, who is one of the most respected environmental journalists in Britain, and has been a long friend of mine and a naturalist, of course, he phoned me up late one night and he said, "Do you know, Jeremy, something extraordinary is happening here. This could be of worldwide significance. Don't you think we ought to be keeping a diary of the effect of all this on nature?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I do keep a nature diary anyway." And he said, "Well, I haven't done in the past, but I will from now on, and let's see what it amounts to." And we quickly enrolled a third person, a friend of ours called Peter Marin, who I have to say he's one of the best all-round naturalists in Britain. He seems to know about everything. He's written books on insects, butterflies, bees, moths, wildflowers. He's an all-round naturalist and, again, a good friend of ours. So we quickly roped him into the enterprise. And from that day onwards, we started keeping a diary. A few days later, we all conferred and we agreed that, you know, this is quite interesting because we each live in a different quarter of Britain. I'm in the east. Mike was in London, and Peter Marin is in the West Country. So spring presents itself in a different way and on a different time scale in each of those areas. And we thought, well, it might be quite interesting to have sort of triangulate the spring in this way and have three views of it, with in the background this growing menace to the human world going on, to see how it might affect the natural world. Anyway, that's how it all started. And pretty soon after we'd been doing it, we thought, well, we've got something here. We ought to be looking for a publisher. And so that's what led to conversations with the publisher, Hodder.
Now, this tradition of observing the natural world in a spot or in an area over a long period of time has a long tradition. In Britain, I think about Gilbert White.
Absolutely.
And other writers like him. But this is distinctively different. And as a reader of it, It was a wild ride because you'd be writing about something about wildflowers or butterflies, and then all of a sudden that, you know, the prime minister is in the hospital with COVID, and then real concerns about what the future brings. And I don't think I've ever read a journal that seesaws between those two realities before. And I'm glad that you wrote it, but it hits the reader on a deeply emotional level because we've all been through that.
Well, that was the contrast that struck us particularly, that the natural world was going on as the natural world does, but in the background there was this drumbeat of the rising numbers of fatalities and, as you say, events like the Prime Minister being taken to intensive care. And another contrast, which was extraordinary, Mark, was that by chance, this happened to be the best spring in Britain.
I know. All three of you mentioned that.
I mean, it was an incredible spring from the day we started almost till the 31st of May, which was our finish point, which is the end of calendar spring. The sun just shone every day. It was the most glorious spring. So here was this contrast between this wonderful, bright spring with wildlife doing what wildlife does in spring, you know, this green wave washing across the whole country. And yet in the background, this darkness and these dire fears So it was an extraordinary emotional contrast. You're quite right, and that's partly what motivated some of the writing, I guess. And towards the end of the book, you'll have noticed that we sort of try and bring this together a bit and reflect on what's happened in these two different worlds, really, and what the responsibility in the future, what we learn from it, what is the responsibility of the human world for the natural world, which has, you know, it's been on the political agenda for a long while, but for us, this brought it all into a very sharp contrast.
One of the interesting things is that because of the restrictions that were going on, you were only allowed out, was it once a day for a walk?
That's right.
So the three of you really made it count. But because there was so less humanity outside, less cars, fewer people, not a lot of air traffic out of Heathrow, that nature responded to the absence of humans, it seemed.
It really did. It nature entered into some of the spaces that human beings had vacated. You probably read that, you know, for the first time in decades, fish could be seen in the canals of Venice. Goats appeared in the high street of a small town in Wales, having come down off the hills. There was a goose that nested in a station, just outside a station garden, because the station wasn't being used. Lots of anecdotes of that kind, and again, you're quite right in saying that the scale of our activities was very limited in one sense, but for me, it was actually liberating. And that was another paradox in this situation. I couldn't walk more. I mean, I couldn't go anywhere except by walking. I could only go out once a day. So I described a radius of about 6 miles around my house, I suppose, and walked there and back, observing in a way that I'd probably never quite observed before. And it wasn't just me. Because people were locked in and could only go out once a day, everybody was noticing things they'd never noticed before close to home. And you're right in saying that it is a wonderful tradition, and Gilbert White is the greatest and most original exponent of it in the 18th century, and I quote him various times in the book because he makes some wonderful remarks like, you know, men shouldn't be too ambitious about traveling the world. They should look at what's close to hand and so on. And we felt that very strongly. And as I say, it was a liberation, not a restriction, to really intensively look closely at what was all around us.
One of the most interesting ones, Michael, who's in London, the city.
Yeah.
He was counting on Kew Gardens being open.
Yes, he was. And he was the one whom the new silence struck most forcibly, because he actually lives quite close to the flight path of Heathrow.
Yeah.
And once the plane stopped, he was hearing things that he'd never heard before. I mean, I think I've been in his house, and every now and again the plane goes over. I forget how many minutes it is, but with great regularity. And they're very used to it. They just stop talking at that point. And you have to wait for the plane to go over. But once Heathrow was closed down, you know, magic happened. Buzzards and kites appeared in the air. And he could hear birdsong that he'd never heard before. Even I could in the country where I am. And, I mean, it's quite an interesting fact that the birds could hear each other better, too. There's been some research recently that shows that many birds cannot now breed or nest within close proximity to our motorways, just because the roar of the traffic blocks out their song, especially the birds with the softer voices, like, our goldcrests, the equivalent of your kinglets.
And, yeah, and they're very high-pitched.
Our tree creeper, brown creeper, isn't it? They've both got very high-pitched songs, and they can't hear each other against the traffic. So the silence was quite extraordinary, and I must say, very beautiful and cleansing. It was as if the whole air had been purified.
What's amazing, I first thought, if it wasn't for the coronavirus, would you have noticed the spring as well as you did?
Not with that intensity.
Yeah.
Not with that intensity.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I always follow the spring. I'm doing so again this spring, even though it's a second coronavirus spring. And I've just 2 days ago, I heard my first chiff-chaff, which is the marker bird for a British bird watcher. They've just arrived, and there it was singing where it was last year when I recorded it in my my diary entry, same bush. But you know, the intensity of all the senses was sharpened by this. We were hearing things. The air was purer. We were touching things that we hadn't touched before. One of us, Peter Maron, started eating leaves to see what they were like. we went feral, basically.
Now, the amazing thing is you're out in the country. Did you see other people walking around?
Yep. I saw people who'd never walked around before.
That's interesting. That's really interesting.
Every day, but other people were going out because they had nothing else for them to do. They were sort of stir crazy, locked in at home. So they went out every day for a walk, and they were taking an interest too. They were looking at things they'd never seen before, and you know, because they know I'm a naturalist, they were asking me questions that had never occurred to them before. And every day we were exchanging little notes. What did I see? What did you see? And so that was very exciting. Have you seen the swallow yet? Have you heard
yes.
the cuckoo yet? You know, all that.
There were all these markers for the three of you. The first swallows were one of them. And the blooms of certain of flowers and stuff like, and the butterflies that you would see. But for all three of you, there were these markers of how spring was progressing. The scary thing, Jeremy, is that, and it's sort of almost heresy to say this, but this is sort of the way it should be. You know, you should be noticing the natural world this much all the time.
Absolutely. So we should.
So
and I hope
yeah.
the habit will persist in some of the people for whom it was a new experience.
Now, because you're you, and we've talked before on this show, you have an amazing literary background. So what was great is you're quoting all sorts of poets and authors. I love that. I think you that quoted Swinburne, "The hounds of spring are on winter's tracks."
Yes, I did, yeah.
That's where we are right here, right now in Massachusetts, is we're getting our first warm days are coming up at the end of this week.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and so the first woodcocks are starting to return.
So
we're starting to see the red-winged blackbirds, our males are starting to be on their territory. And you get to notice the same thing. And I became as fascinated with these everyday sightings through your writing, like the kingfisher. For people who don't know the European kingfisher, it's a very different species than the American kingfisher, which is a big, bulky kingfisher. Talk to me about the European kingfisher.
Yeah, you're right. Our kingfisher is quite small. It's about the size of, it's a bit smaller than an American robin and quite chunky.
And very beautiful. The colors on it are amazing.
The colors are spectacular. It's got a kind of, when it flies, there's an electric blue flash. Quite extraordinary. Of course, because it flies very fast, you don't really ever get a still frame view of it. You get a sort of blue blur, and we are lucky enough where I live to have kingfishers nesting in the river, which is very close to my house. But many people have never seen them because they're just so quick, even though they're so colourful. The back is this electric blue. The front is a bright ruddy red colour. And they are the most beautiful. Yours is the belted kingfisher, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a spectacular bird too. I have to say that. But yours is. You're right. You barely get a glimpse as it goes by. If you're lucky, you see it perched on a reed or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's an amazingly elusive bird, simply because it's so quick.
There are people who've lived in the village and never seen one, and I'm glad to say that I was able to show some of those people them during this last spring. But often people say to me, you know, are there still kingfishers in the village, Jeremy? And I say, oh, yes, you just have to know where to look. And the way to find kingfishers in Britain is to listen, actually. And as you know, it's the way to find a lot of birds.
Oh, yeah.
The kingfisher always gives a clue. There's a little high-pitched call, and if you can tune into it, you know that in about 5 seconds there'll be a kingfisher whizzing under the bridge where you're standing. But you have to be very quick. As I remember, your belted kingfisher has quite a raucous call.
Oh, yeah, it's a huge, long rattle. But it's the same thing. It gives it out just as it's about to take off, and then it. Yeah. But it also perches out obviously on like stubs and stuff like that a lot more than the European kingfisher does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now was it you that had the report? Somebody reported to you that there was a dipper in the stream.
Yes, yeah, someone did.
Now explain, for people who've never, we have a dipper out west, the American dipper. The Eurasian dipper actually is a beautiful amount of white on the front of it.
It does. It's got a huge white belly, which is very prominent when they're sitting in the middle of a stream, sort of bobbing up and down the way they do. I've never seen one in this county here, let alone in the village. It's a bird of more northern rapid streams.
Well, that's like our dipper is a bird of the Rockies.
Yeah, yeah. Fast-flowing rivers.
Yeah.
That's what they need. Most of them feed on caddis fly, I think, and insects like that. People often report extraordinary things to me. A woman the other day, you'd be interested, Mark, said to me, have you seen any butterflies yet, Jeremy? And I said, no, not yet this year, but I'm waiting. And I've got one or two hibernating in my woodshed. Oh, that's funny, she said. I've got one in my woodshed too. You know, it's a monarch butterfly.
What?
And I said, a monarch butterfly? I said, you have to be tactful on these occasions.
I know. I've been through stuff like this.
I said, well, that's really very interesting. But then I caught something in her voice. I hadn't met her before. And I said, wait a minute. I said, are you American? And she said, oh, yeah, I come from California.
Oh, okay.
So I've been in Britain for a long time. So I said, yes, you do, of course, see monarch butterflies there. But I think you've probably mistaken this one for a small tortoise shell. And she promised to send me a picture, which she hasn't yet done. But,
Well, this dipper didn't turn out to be a dipper.
No, it wasn't. It was a sandpiper. But, it had some superficial similarities.
Well, it's very similar to one of our species. This was a common sandpiper. Our spotted sandpiper is extremely similar in form. It just has spots in front, and the common sandpiper doesn't.
Yeah, that's right. When they behave the same way, don't they?
Oh, they absolutely the same way.
And they're both dumpy little birds with, fairly short tails. So
and they do a little rumba. They do a little rumba with their rear end as they walk along the shore.
Exactly. Yeah. No, so it wasn't a bad call, but I knew it couldn't be a dipper when I was told that.
But people need to know that's what natural historians go through all the time. There's always some extraordinary thing that's been seen. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to him, is writer, editor Jeremy Minot, Emeritus Fellow of Wilson College, Cambridge. And he, with Michael McCarthy and Peter Marin, have written, I think, one of the most interesting natural history books of the last several years, The Constellation of Nature, Spring and the Time of the Coronavirus. You also had a great sighting. And I'm very jealous as a birder. You had three scavengers on a corpse.
Oh, yes.
Well, that's rare.
That's rare in itself, but the species that were represented was even more interesting because... let me just remember, one of them
was the buzzard.
Raven.
No, one of them
was a
raven.
Which are now common around here. They didn't used to be. They used to be a West Country bird, but they've spread east now.
That's really funny because ravens have spread. They used to be a wilderness bird here and not even found in Massachusetts, except maybe out in the Berkshires. Now they're all the way across the state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, all three of them were birds that have suffered persecution in the past.
You had a buzzard.
The buzzard is the commonest one now. And that's one of the commonest birds of prey in Britain. Now.
That's a beautio. So that's sort of the analog of our red-tailed hawk.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Or yeah. They don't look the same.
Broad-winged. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you had a red kite.
Then we had a red kite, which is a more recent success story. That 50 years ago, they were just restricted to a very small area of Wales, and the total UK population was down to about 30. But since then, they've spread, and there have been a series of reintroductions which have assisted the process. And now, although it's not a common bird, I do see them, most months. There's a pair breeding not 5 miles from here, so I do see them quite often. And they're the most beautiful birds, of course. They've got this gorgeous ruddy plumage and the most wonderful forked tail, which whose wingtips operate, whose tail feathers operate quite independently of each other.
Yeah,
so you
yeah.
can see them sort of feathering the breeze to get perfect aeronautical control. They're wonderful birds. And that was one of them. So the raven, the kite, and the buzzard, and all of them had been suffered from persecution. And I was rather satisfied with this little story because the corpse that they were scavenging was that of a pheasant.
Oh, wow.
In whose name the gamekeepers had been killing them all.
That's right, and that's an introduced species.
That's right, an introduced species, which I think is out of control in this country. They release 40 or 50 million pheasants a year for the shooting sporting industry.
They do the same here.
And they've just swamped the woodlands. It's a non-native bird. It's had all kinds of other side effects, and they're only released in order to be killed.
I always found that a bit perverse. And the ones that they release have very little, like I couldn't hit one with a stick around here. The ones they release seem to be so tame. I don't know where the sport is in hunting it. It's like ridiculous.
No, and that's quite true.
We're going to run out of time. I have so much I want to talk to you about this book. One of the species I'm glad you mentioned was the yellowhammer.
Oh, yes, the yellowhammer.
When my first trip to Britain, I heard about yellowhammers and their song, and I learned that mnemonic, a little bit of bread and no cheese.
That's right. Well, like a number of these mnemonics, it's not exactly accurate, but it's quite helpful to have in your mind. What it really does is...
Yeah.
So it's a stuttering call followed by a rather hoarse call. So it's more like a little bit of bread, geez.
But it's a beautiful bird.
It's a beautiful canary yellow color.
Yeah.
And it's a bird of farmland, much reduced in numbers now, like other common farmland species.
Absolutely.
And for the same reasons of habitat loss and overuse of pesticides and so on. But they are in the village. I got a bit worried this year, the year that I was reporting here, because they hadn't started singing the week they usually start. And I'm quite sensitive to this question. I keep records of when birds sing. And I was beginning to wonder whether they were, you know, whether we were losing them. But later on, it chimed in, and I was very relieved. But the loss of common farmland birds is, I'm afraid, a familiar story in Britain.
And you talk that story is told in this book, and one of the problems is the loss of hedgerows.
Yes, that's right.
People here don't know about the importance of hedgerows.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, of course, you have these huge, huge fields, don't you?
And, we don't have that traditional hedgerow that used to go up in between fields.
Yeah, well, the hedgerows were boundary markers, of course, and the farmers didn't realize, or no one realized, how important they were to wildlife until they'd gone. The hedgerows are corridors, they're larders, they're places to nest. They were crucial to all kinds of not only birds, but insects and small mammals too. A lot of them were rooted out in the last 50 years in the interest of having larger fields, which were thought to be more cost-effective to farm. And in fact, it was a perverse wish, because once they'd been taken out, the winds roared across some of these fields
right.
and took off the topsoil. And not exactly dust bowl conditions, but, you know, in the same category, as it were. And we had a catastrophic loss of farmland birds. Some of the figures are, frightening. The turtle dove, for example, we've lost, in the last 50 years, we've lost 97% of the turtle doves. And, you know, that's an iconic species in British culture. We've probably lost 60% of the yellowhammers, and we've lost about 80% of the skylarks, another iconic bird. And this is all to do with changed farming methods.
Is there a sense of turning the tide on that and replanting hedgerows?
There is. Much encouraged by all the naturalist organizations, of course, and also now many farmers are now becoming, there has been something of a conversion, I'd say. over the last few years. At last, the conservation bodies, what you might call the green movement, is having some political effect. And even, if I may say that, our present government is now introducing or threatening to introduce some environmental friendly policies. So I think things are going in the right direction now, but there's an awful lot of ground to make up. And I fear some of these things have been reduced to such a low population level that they won't recover.
We're almost out of time, but I want to say there was one sighting in particular I was very jealous of. You sighted a weasel.
Oh, yes, a weasel, a small weasel, yeah.
Which species of weasel? Is that our least weasel here? I think it is. I think the least weasel.
I think it is, yeah. It's much smaller than a stoat, smaller than your polecat, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very small, it's really very thin. A weasel can get through a tiny, tiny hole, and they hunt rats, rabbits, any small mammals. And yes, we have some of them here, and they're delightful to look at because their movement is so rapid and sinuous.
Yes.
They sort of flow over the ground. It's a wonderful thing to watch.
We have, here in Massachusetts, we have long and short-tailed weasels, but we don't have least weasels. Those are further to the west and the south.
Right.
And so I've never seen one, and I've always wanted it. And whenever you get a sighting of a weasel, it's typically a brief view. They sort of look at you, and then they dart off elsewhere. But that was one of those sightings in this book that I was I would give anything to see that. Now, let me, in these last minutes, is there a sense of doing a part two of this?
Well,
I don't know about you, but we're still in the midst of things here. I mean, people are starting to get their shots. I got my first shot, but we're still dealing with it here.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd love to think so. I mean, we wrote this book very quickly indeed. I mean, the last entries were on the 31st of May. We delivered it to a publisher in June, and it was published in October.
Oh, my God.
So it was very rapid. But we so much, enjoyed sounds a bit, it sounds an inappropriate word to use when there's a coronavirus and pandemic going on, but we were so absorbed in what we were doing, that's a better way of putting
it. Fantastic.
We thought, well, maybe we should continue this for the autumn. So we went on keeping autumn diaries, and we've still all got those if we ever needed to write them up.
Well, I hope there's a part two. We're completely out of time. My returning guest tonight is writer-editor Jeremy Minot. He's an emeritus fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge. And along with Michael McCarthy and Peter Marin, they have written, I think, one of the most fascinating natural history books of the last couple of years, The Consolation of Nature, Spring in the Time of the Coronavirus. Jeremy, I hope we talk again soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.